everybody. Welcome to another edition of Sunday Unpacked. This is Monica, and I am with Pastor James. How are you this bright, sunny day?
I know, it's nice.
It is so beautiful out there. Almost wish we could do this outside.
Yeah.
That would be cool. So did we get any questions today?
I did not get any questions online, you know, by text or email or anything. So
I didn't either. So come on, everybody, send us your questions about Sunday's sermons. The text is 217-712-6621 and email us at questions@taylorvillechristian.com. And as always, you can put your questions on the Connect card and put them in the offering plate on Sunday when it comes around. So Sunday's sermon, Sunday, March 9th, you kind of expanded on the invitation part of the story of God's love, where he invites us into his story.
Right.
And it goes to a more personal level, and we're studying Abram.
Right. And a hero of faith and yes. A man who also struggled.
Right. And last week he had the call or the covenant. And this week we're talking about doubt.
We will.
And
yes.
You had said, yeah, you said, have you ever had trouble trusting God? And oh my gosh, that is kind of a loaded question for me. Is it kind of for you? Do you ever?
I think it is for most everybody who wants to be a person of faith in Jesus, because we want to have perfect faith, right? But the reality is most of us don't. So then, you know, that can lead to even a sense of guilt or something's wrong with me or whatever.
Right.
But sooner or later, I think most Christians face this.
Yeah. I never have trouble doubting God's power or ability, his greatness and stuff. It's just overwhelming to me how powerful and how mighty he is and how good and how right. I don't doubt that he keeps his promises to other people. I sometimes doubt, why would he keep his promises to me?
Right.
Why, you know, I'm very unworthy. I'm not at all deserving. And I think that kind of comes back to my earlier childhood and even into adulthood views of a transactional view of faith.
Right. If I do enough good, then God owes me something.
Yeah. Not necessarily that he owes me. It's kind of a what you would call a tit for tat. You know, if you do this, then I'll do that. And it's not about deserving. It's about because we never deserve it. But I guess it's about earning.
Yeah.
Earning. Like, have I earned it? And that's not how God is. And I think it's, as an adult, it's been very hard for me to get past that learning.
Well, and I would echo that my struggle is not usually with can God do something. It's more a question of will God do something. And then you know, there's various reasons we might wonder, you know, like, or not even understand why God has not done something that seems like it's an obvious thing. When someone we love is hurting, is sick, why wouldn't God bring healing to them? Because we're unhappy, they're unhappy, maybe they're suffering, and I don't think God enjoys that. So why wouldn't he just bring healing to them? Well, we don't always get those answers. So, I mean, that sort of swirls around in my head when I get to that kind of point in life. It's not could God do it, but will he? Or why hasn't he? Or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're at the point in Genesis 12 where Abram has been called to leave his family, leave everything he knew, and take his wife and his belongings and leave.
And he did
And he did. Abram went. And then right after the verses of Abram went and settled in near Shechem and in the land of Canaan, but then there was a famine in the land, Abram went down to Egypt to live there for a while because the famine was severe. That's Genesis 12:10, where we started in the text on Sunday. So did Abraham decide on his own to go to Egypt? Did God send him? Was Abram doubting, you know, I mean, well, what's going on? And we don't know that, I don't think.
Well, we don't.
It's a question I want to ask.
Yeah, there's the answer, right? I mean, it'd be nice if we did know, because there's a sense in which we go, well, God has said he would protect Abram and bless him and make his name great. And if he's afraid of starving, why didn't he just wait on God to provide for him and for his wife and his servants? Instead, he goes off to Egypt. Well, is that because he's not trusting, or is that because he's using an obvious solution that God put in front of him? Go, here's where food is, go get it. And I, we're not really told if this was like, there's no, well, this was the right choice or this was the wrong choice, or God directed him to do this, at least not that I know of. So we're sort of left wondering ourselves. And I think that's the way life is for us too, right? I mean, there are times when we're dealing with a problem and maybe we don't have a sense that God is showing me the obvious solution, but there is sort of an obvious solution out there. And maybe God expects us to use our good sense to pursue it, you know? And I think that's basically what Abram does here. Could he have stayed where he was and trusted that God would provide? Well, he probably could have done that too. And I have a sense that God would have, because God has promised that he would make him a great nation. And the only way to do that was to keep him alive. So I wish we knew a little more there.
Yeah. It's kind of my next question kind of goes along with that. Was travel to Egypt in itself doubting God's ability or God's willingness to care for Abram and fulfill his promise? Or
we're not again, told that, but
we don't know Abram's thoughts.
Right. We don't.
So are there still periodic famines in Israel, which would encourage people to migrate south? I mean, you know, I don't know.
I don't
know
either.
It seems a dry place.
Yeah, for sure. You know, we live in a different world in that there is so much easier to move food around the world right now than it is to move a bunch of people to where the food is. So I don't really know enough about the current sort of agricultural and economic situation in that part of the world to answer that question very well. But I mean, we still certainly do have problems like this, right? I mean, I know where I visited this fall in Zimbabwe, they were struggling a little bit after I was there because it was, it should be the rainy season and it was too dry. So they were concerned they were going to have to import a lot of food to Zimbabwe to keep people alive. And it just shows that, you know, that fragility is still present in the world. And people do sometimes have to move to try to deal with that kind of fragility. But we also go to greater lengths to get food to them, which is good because it's a whole lot easier to move food than people.
Well, and then the advances in irrigation systems
absolutely.
Things like that. Yeah. So it's very hard to for us to even contemplate what this type of famine would be like.
It is. Thankfully.
Yeah. I do remember in some of my Western Civ class and then different studies on the region about the land in Egypt by the Nile River that you had mentioned was known as the breadbasket.
Right.
And the area around the Nile River was called the Kemet. Am I saying that right?
K-E-M-E-T? I do not know that word, so it looks like it. Yeah.
And that it meant black land. And you are not from Illinois. You're not a native from this area.
That is true.
But I remember growing up just noticing how black the soil was. I lived in a small farming community, you know, two blocks away that was all field. And on the way to school, we walked past fields or in fields or through fields or between fields. Just how black the soil was when they would disc it up in the spring. And
It's something that we noticed upon moving here because, you know, where we're from in Georgia, it's all red. It's red clay. So, you know, a dirt road is red in Georgia. It's not red in Illinois. That's a different thing entirely. So, it's definitely something that we see here. same kind of fertile land.
Yeah, the smell when you can, it's like growing up, I always knew when the seasons were changing depending on the smells from the field. And it just was something really cool. And I would imagine that's very much what it was like in the fertile areas by the Nile River.
Right.
Yeah. And I like that it's something I can relate to when I hear things like that, the bread basket and just different. So, all right. So Abram's headed down to this fertile area in Egypt, and led by God or not led by God to go down there, he was seeking food. And he says to his wife, Sarai, "Say you are my sister so that I'll be treated well for your sake, and my life will be spared because of you." And that's Genesis 12:13. Was there something in the culture in Egypt that prompted Abram to fear this?
Well, I am not what the scholars would call an Egyptologist, who is an expert in ancient Egyptian culture. But the commentaries that I read said, you know, basically, we're not sure why Abram was so afraid of this. There's no really logical reason that in Egypt it would be any different than it was in Canaan. So we're not sure why he was so afraid. What we do know is that later on in the story, he does it again. And I don't know that I'm going to preach on that text, because we can't preach on every, you know, every part of this whole story. But he does the same thing. And it's not in Egypt. It's a different group of people. So why does he have this fear of this? And in that story, he does say, you know, one of the things is I told Sarai for her to do when we got married was that when we went to a place like this to say he is my brother, that would be the way she would show her love. And well, that seems an odd way to show your love, to not own up that you're married. But somehow he had a deep-seated fear of this. And I don't know if it had to do with his culture or his person or, you know, his emotional makeup, but clearly it was a big deal.
Well, and both times it put her, let's just say, in the arms of someone who wasn't her husband.
Which is bizarre. I do not know. I mean, it is very strange.
So was Abram's anticipation of problems kind of a reflection of human fear and survival instincts, like, or was it a spiritual response to the serpent's age-old question, did God really say, which we heard in Genesis 3:1?
Right. I don't know the answer to that question completely, but I think it's at least the first one, right? I don't have any doubt that this is fear in the mind of Abram. He is definitely afraid that he's going to be killed so that someone else can marry his wife if he owns up that they're married. Now, I think the second part of what you said is there because God has made this promise, right? I mean, it's a clear promise. And both now and later in the story, he struggles to believe that and makes some sort of these dumb decisions because he's not sure he can trust God to keep his promises. So there's definitely real human fear, but I think it's probably combined with this sense of, is God going to keep his promise?
Yeah. Do you find that we still do that today during times of fear or lack of control or lack of security? I know I do.
Oh, sometimes. Yeah.
I'm like, is God really gonna? And it's, if we could see Satan actually saying, is God really gonna take care of you?
Well, yeah, it'd be different then. Know,
it would be so different.
Yeah.
But it's just those sly little, like instances or little suggestions of doubt in our mind.
Yeah. And this question of, you know, even if we're sort of dealing with not so much God promised to do something he hasn't done it yet, but maybe there's a big need in my life that God's not meeting. Why is he not meeting it? That's when it's easy for me to sort of drift into either despair, like this is not going to get better. It's just, this is the way it is and it's really bad and it's, that's just it. Along with sort of this sort of cynicism, a real negative approach to how I understand the world and my circumstance. And I'm, you know, I'm sort of laying some stuff out there, but that's real for me. And I have to guard against that because, you know, it leads, it's a sense of hopelessness is what it is really. Right. And that hopelessness sort of manifests itself in a negativity that's not good for me or the people around me. So I have to really work on that when things are, when things are not like I want them to be. And so far God's not changing it.
Yeah. That's a hard place to be. I think, you know, I had an example of this for John and I during our grief journey, especially early on. I would have moments of great faith and believing that God had us no matter what and that I could trust him. But then, you know, those like, I don't want to say not necessarily jealousy, but envy of anyone who was able to have a healthy baby and have a child, especially if I heard them complaining about being too tired. And I would be like, oh, shut up. I would give anything to have sleepless nights because my child was crying, you know? Yeah. And don't you know how good you have it? And things like that. And that would bring on or allow a bitterness. And like, why would God allow someone who's complaining about their kid all the time to have a kid? And then we don't have one.
It's a real mystery. And, I mean, we dealt with that with the same thing with infertility and that you're wondering, we so desperately want a child and this couple over here seems ungrateful for the one that they have. And, and they were, they were saying the same normal things that people just say because you are tired and you are worn out. And that's part of parenting, especially a little one. Right. And they weren't really doing anything wrong. But from my perspective, which was sort of that cynicism, it didn't seem fair. When it, frankly, it's not fair. It's not about fair. Right. But we have a sense of fairness, especially related to our own feelings. And so I did struggle with that a lot. It's not exactly the same as grief. I'm not equating that.
No. Well, it is a grief. It is a grief response.
But it's a different kind of grief than losing a child, I'm sure. Yeah. So,
But then I look at Abram and I think, you know, here he has heard from God a couple times that God's going to take care of him. And then all of a sudden there's a famine.
Well, yeah.
Is God really going to take care of us? We'll just go down here. Oh, but wait a minute. If we go down there, some things could go wrong down there too. And like they could take my wife and they could kill me to have her. And well, would it be better if I just lied and said she's my sister? And so she can, I mean, you know, you can run the narrative in your head if you put yourself in his spot.
And here's what I find interesting in that is that, I mean, I've probably said this, you know, if I was a biblical character and God told me something face to face, boy, it'd be a whole lot easier to believe it than 2000 years later when all we have is the story or the scripture or whatever. It'd be so much easier if I heard the voice of God speak it, then I could believe it.
Yeah. So we think,
right. I mean, Abram seems to have struggled just as much as we do with stuff like that.
Yeah.
So maybe it's not any easier. You know, it doesn't seem to be for him.
Yeah. So the first nine verses of Genesis 12, we're seeing Abraham again. I think I mentioned this a little bit earlier. He leaves the comfort of his earthly father's household. He leaves his earthly identity behind because it was a patriarchal society back then. You were your family.
Correct.
And your family was you. And that had some security.
Absolutely.
Physical, financial, economic, you know, status. But he left all that in order to go where God told him. And in the coming chapters, we're going to see how time and again, Abram's human nature comes out in his actions that attempt to recapture for himself and his entourage that old life feeling of security and comfort rather than finding it in a place of obedience to God.
That's right. He does over and over in different ways, you know, really different ways. This is one, but we'll see it at work in other ways as well.
Right. And 4,000 years later, have we really come so very far from trying to do the same thing? I mean,
human nature just doesn't change that much.
Yeah, it doesn't. And we want to manipulate. Oh, yeah, this is my, you know, we may not say, hey, this dude is my brother, not my husband. But we do things to manipulate and to kind of control the narrative instead of just allowing God to work things out.
Yeah, we want to control the outcome. So we know if I put these things in, I'm going to get this out. And I'm sort of trusting that God's going to give us what's best instead of being in control of that is a really hard thing for most of us to do.
And you said earlier something about, was it Abram's just his thoughts of, hey, we could go here, you know? How do we discern what is our God-given wisdom versus our human nature attempting to control a situation?
I mean, that's a challenge, right? Because God does give us a brain to use, and I think he expects us to problem solve some things in life and not just sort of sit back and let them fall apart around us.
Right.
On the other hand, you know, where's the line that runs between me trying to control everything and me taking initiative and using the gifts and abilities and opportunities God puts in front of me in a way that is good for the people around me. So those are challenging questions that I think we have to ask ourselves over and over throughout life.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think near the end of this session, some of the things we're going to talk about will help.
Yeah.
I think us to be in a place where we can hear and discern more. So Genesis 12:17 is where we're at next. But the Lord inflicted serious diseases on Pharaoh and his household because of Abram's wife, Sarai. How does God's intervention in Pharaoh's household reveal his justice and the protection of his chosen Abram and his descendants?
So at one level, this doesn't feel exactly fair either, because, I mean, Abram said, this is my sister, so how's he to know? And yet God has a sense of justice here, so God doesn't want to allow something that's clearly immoral to continue to stand, so he steps in to deal with it. At one level, Pharaoh pays the price for Abram's sin. Is that fair? Well, probably not. But the point is that Abram is this man that God has chosen to fulfill his covenant and his promise in, and he's continually showing that. And then he'll show that through his descendants as well. So this is God at work in a specific plan to accomplish his purposes. You know, these things that Pharaoh suffers are not permanent either. So they do come to an end when things are made right. So it's not that God, you know, is out there torturing him endlessly, but that it's a sign that something needs to change, which Pharaoh seems to figure that out and somehow knows that it's Abram who's caused it. So we got to deal with the problem. So God is prompting something to change.
Right. And you mentioned that in your sermon that we don't know how Pharaoh found out, but
it
came to his knowledge.
Right.
So how does this reveal potential consequences of our decisions on others, if we compare to the plight of Pharaoh?
Well, and you know, again, God's still a God of righteousness and good and justice, and there are times when he disciplines us, right? Things that we are involved with that we know we shouldn't be, and God may give us signs that things need to change. So I think God's still at work trying to point us toward righteousness, even when that may be uncomfortable at times. But we have to pay attention and we have to be self-reflective. So when that happens, we recognize, oh, yeah, this thing I'm doing is clearly wrong and needs to change.
I think it kind of shows, too, that even if you are chosen to be God's instrument, as Abram was, you still have a responsibility.
Absolutely.
And Abram had to be transparent. Yes, I lied. She is my wife, not my sister. And so I think those are, authenticity is kind of an important thing to remember in leadership. And, you know, Pharaoh was merciful. He didn't kill Abram.
He could
have very easily done that. That kind of, I know we haven't gotten to Genesis 13, 1 and 2, but I just want to kind of point out to everyone what happened after this. Abram went up from Egypt to the Negev with his wife and everything he had, and Lot went with him. Abraham had become very wealthy in livestock and in silver and gold. So when Pharaoh and his whole household left Egypt, they were wealthier than when they went to Egypt.
Yeah. I mean, it says that he prospers in the middle of chapter 12 as well. And we know, to compare this to the other event that takes place later in Abram's life, with Abimelech, he does the same thing. And, again, the sin is recognized, and Abimelech gives him 25, or what is that? It amounts to 25 pounds of silver. I don't think that that's the way it's worded, but it's listed in shekels. But point is, it's a lot of silver, and it is more than any common man would expect to earn in his lifetime.
Right.
So
that's crazy.
It is. And Abimelech gives that to Abram, even though Abram's the one who has lied. So it's sort of, it repeats. So he does prosper because of this. And again, we go, well, that doesn't seem completely fair. But I think we have to see the overarching work of God in his life to get him to the point of being the father of many nations. And this is right. Part of the process.
And that story of Abimelech is Genesis 20, correct?
I think it is, yeah.
I think I had referenced it in my studies, so I think it's Genesis 20, if anyone wants to read that. I want to kind of point out that, number one, we can't really do anything so ghastly that we're going to mess up God's plan for the world, for salvation, for the world and eternity with him.
Yeah, I don't
we
have that
cannot
kind of power.
Undo that.
Right.
But we do have a responsibility and there are consequences, and it's only by God's grace and mercy that he continues to use us.
Correct.
To bring about his salvation to others. Just like it's only because of God's grace and mercy he continued to use Abram.
Yeah, correct? Even in the face of our sin and our unrighteousness, God shows grace and allows us to be part of his plan, part of his story, though we've not earned a spot in that story. You know, we don't deserve to be characters in that play, and yet he allows us to be.
Right. So that was my next question, was in what ways does this chapter show that God's plans prevail despite human errors and misjudgments? And we just talked about that.
Yeah, and it runs all the way through the story of Abram. I mean, Abram is not perfect.
Right.
We've talked a little bit about that already, and I talked about it Sunday, and that's really not the point of the story. The point of the story is not, here's a sinless man. The point of the story is, here is a man like us who has moments of great faith and moments of either doubt or just plain sin or whatever, and God has an amazing way of using us and allowing us to be part of what he's doing, even in the face of those flaws, which is a tremendous blessing.
Right. And yet all of this, Abram is considered in the New Testament by some of our New Testament writers to be a hero of faith.
Absolutely.
And even though he did some really dumb things.
Mm-hmm.
And God used Abram even though he was messed up. And God can use us even though we mess up.
That's right. That's right.
And the point is not what we do necessarily or how bad we sin or that. It's all about eternity with Christ. That's what the whole story of Abram is about. It's about finding a way. Well, not finding a way. It's about God presenting his story of love for us so that we can spend eternity with him.
Right.
That's what it's all about.
It's always forward facing.
Yes. So we have to keep our eyes on eternity and not what's right in front of us. Just like Abram could have kept his eyes on eternity, but he got his eyes off of eternity and on the famine and on the danger that could potentially be to his person.
Right.
What are some things that we can do to daily remember and live in the presence of God and look to eternity?
Well, I mean, I think part of this has to be prayer. And not just, okay, I have this, you know, 5 minutes where I pray to God every morning or every night or whatever. It's really, to effectively do that, I think prayer has to be part of the day. Part of, it's a continual conversation with God. So, yeah, we have work to do and things to do with our family, but there are moments when we can pause. There are moments when we can say even just a few words to include God in, to allow God to speak into what we're doing is probably a better way of saying that. So it's not so much, God's there whether we acknowledge him or not.
Exactly.
So it's not up to me to bring God in. It's more opening ourselves up to God and to be in his presence all day long rather than some segmented part of life, because that's just not enough. So we want God to be present in all of it so that we do make the right decisions, sort of built on faith, growing out of faith rather than our own sense of control.
Yeah. So, you know, it's not just pray more, read the Bible more.
Yeah,
It's kind of about meditating on it and acknowledging his presence in every moment.
Yeah. And so it's more than, I mean, the typical answers to things like this are to pray and to read the Bible. And sometimes those are the right answer. And at one level, those are part of the right answer to this. Because, I mean, I said that if we don't actually read about God's promises, we don't know what God has promised. So maybe we're expecting God to do something that he never promised to do. So we do need to know what God actually said. What he actually promises us. And we also need to talk to him about that, to invite him to be at work in us, to change us, to keep those promises in our lives, in our families, in our churches, in our world. And so prayer and Bible study are, I mean, they're tied into this, but it's really a little more than just the, you know, again, the 10 minutes of quiet time or whatever you want to call it that you might have with God in the morning, it's allowing that to permeate the rest of life.
Right. And you did mention study to know God's promises. And you made a very valid and difficult point that God did not promise a life of ease. That was never one of his promises.
And we wish it was, right? I mean, it sure would be easier if it was God's going to take away my struggles, but that's not what he ever says.
Right. Well, and I think even in the New Testament, didn't Jesus say in this world, you're going to have trouble?
Yeah, right.
You're going to have trouble because you're trying to live a different way. You're trying to live for eternity and not for now. And that's going to go against culture.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. That's right. It goes against the grain of what we have around us.
But God did promise a life of forgiveness when we mess up or make stupid decisions like Abram did.
Correct.
He did promise his love and his presence. And he did promise that he is faithful. So those were your sermon points Sunday. So can you share, can we talk about some powerful verses that each one of us, it's spoken to us? I know we went through them separately and had a lot of the same ones you said after you read up through mine. So forgiveness, love, presence, and faithfulness, that God keeps his promise. So let's talk about those.
Well, I think one of the most important verses in the Bible, in the New Testament for sure, that talk about forgiveness is, and I come back to this so often, is 1 John 1:9. Mm-hmm. If we confess our sins, he's faithful and just and will forgive us of our sins and purify us from all unrighteousness. And so many people struggle to believe that God can actually forgive their sins because, you know, nobody's done what I've done. You just don't know all the bad things that I've... Well, no, I don't, but God does. And none of it's going to surprise him. I don't really think we've come up with a whole lot of novel ways to sin. We're humans who keep doing the same stupid stuff. But this verse is really clear that if we take that sin to God and openly confess it, you know, this is what I've done, that he will forgive it. And I think that's part of the good news of the gospel. It's the good news of being a follower of Jesus, that sin really can be forgiven and we don't have to worry about it once we take it to him.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like that. 1 John is really a good book.
It's a great book.
I really like that one. One of my favorites is Ephesians 1:7. In him we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of sin in accordance with the riches of God's grace.
Right.
Meaning it's not about us. It's not about what we do. We just have to lay it all at his feet and allow him to forgive us.
Yeah. And it's not a limited grace, right? It's the riches of God's grace. Riches, so there's an abundance of God's grace there. It's not that we're going to somehow run out at some point. God's grace is super abundant in our lives. And so we can depend on that forgiveness all the way through.
Did you have any more for forgiveness?
No, that's the one that I usually come back to over and over.
Okay. And then of course you have the one, Jesus with his disciples at the Last Supper saying, this is the blood of my covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins.
And we'll definitely come to that verse, either that, which is Matthew, or the account in Luke where he talks about the new covenant. That's going to be a theme that we'll look at as we go through this whole year long series.
All right. And the covenant is, again, it's God fulfilling his side of the promise.
And that's where we'll focus a little bit this coming Sunday, because we'll be talking about this passage in Genesis 15, where God has pointed to the covenant that he wants to have with Abram. He's begun to lay that out, but it is laid out more clearly in Genesis 15 than anywhere before. So we talked about the covenant with Noah. We're going to come back to that and see it really at work in the covenant with Abram that then is fulfilled in Jesus. So it has bearing on us as well.
That's awesome. All right. So love, let's talk about encouraging verses or reminders of God's love.
Well, you actually used it in a different area, but for me, the one that immediately comes to mind is Romans 8. Mm-hmm. Where Paul says, I'm convinced that neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, neither the present nor the future, nor any powers, neither height nor depth, nor anything else in all creation. So that's everything, good, bad, otherwise, whatever struggle it is, will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus, our Lord. And I use that one frequently at either funeral services or at the graveside, because one of the things that we need to know is that even death itself does not separate us from the love of God. And it is always there. So God has an eternal love for each one of us. And I think there's great peace in that.
Yeah, I used that for God's presence, that which, he is, I mean, always with us.
It's there too. Yes. I mean, both those.
Yes,
are,
it is. Yeah. I like 1 John 3:1. See what great love the Father has lavished on us that we should be called children of God.
Right.
And just to be his child. And
yeah,
then
we've been adopted in. Yeah.
Yes. Jeremiah 31:3. And that you really probably need context with that, because yeah, that is after Israel has failed time and time again and has sure betrayed God. And he says to them, I have loved you with an everlasting love. I have drawn you with unfailing kindness. He just wants to be our father. He just right wants a relationship with us. And I think of parent-child relationships that kind of are strained. Mm-hmm. And no matter how strained it is, or how frustrated we are with our children, or how frustrated our parents were with us, that love cannot be shaken.
That's right.
Nine times out. I mean, for me, I know there's nothing that my kids could do that would make me right not
even
love
if
them
the relationship is strained or broken or whatever else.
I still love them. Right. Yes. Right. I mean, my, yes. So those are my, and of course our theme verse for,
yeah, I don't think we can get away from that, because
we cannot.
Speaks
yeah
to what we're doing this year.
And do you want to go ahead and read that for him?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Your love, Lord, reaches to the heavens, your faithfulness to the skies. And I mean, we're using that. We're talking about it. Again, we're going to come to that and explore it in a little more detail. And it's actually even fuller and more expansive than it sounds on his first reading. But the point is, God's love is overflowing toward us.
Yeah. That's just, that was Psalm 36:5. And that's right like our theme for this whole year. I think that we're not going to be able to understand. I hope that it shows us how rich and deep and full God's love right actually is for us. So we're on verses for the presence, for God's presence in our lives. What you got for that one?
Well, I think the one that comes to mind first is, you know, maybe one of the best known passages in the Bible, and that's Psalm 23. Mm-hmm. That, I mean, it ends with those words, we'll dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Mm-hmm. So we will be in God's presence forever. Mm-hmm. The other one that comes to my mind is from Isaiah 40. And this is another familiar one, at least the end of it. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. He gives strength to the weary. So, you know, it's the God's presence gives us strength. So he gives us right strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. So even as we wear out, it feels like God is mm-hmm with us and carries us through the really hard times.
Yeah. That was one that was very, probably read that at least once a week, if not daily, during times of really dark days during right grief. Yeah,
yeah,
it's a good one. That is a great passage. I also liked, where can I go from your spirit?
Yeah, sure.
Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn or settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me and your right hand will hold me fast. That's Psalm 139:7-10. And that, you know, if I'm in the heights of worship, God is there. But if I'm in the depths of despair, God is also there.
Right.
It doesn't matter. He's there with me.
I mean, the point of that one is almost you can't escape the presence
right
of God.
Yes.
Even if you wanted to, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it, that you can't escape God's presence. I love it. All right, so God's faithfulness, he keeps his promises. What do you have? to encourage our listeners?
You know, I would think of a couple that come, Psalm 86, 15, but you, Lord, are a compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness. God's faithfulness. Mm. And then one that I think both of us turn to, a book that we don't go to very often, Lamentations.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Chapter 3. Beginning verse 22, because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed, for his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. And, you know, I think that was set to music years ago, and that song comes to my mind even now. And sometimes those songs do come back that are, you know, based in scripture and sort of plant the seed of that scripture in us. And that's one of those that does for me, that God's faithfulness doesn't end, and it is, again, super abundant. It is always there. There's plenty.
Mm-hmm. That's good. I like 2 Timothy 3:13, where Paul tells us that even if we are faithful, he remains faithful.
Even if we are faithless.
Yes, even if we are faithless. Yeah, sorry about that. He remains faithful. I think that is...
I think it's great. Yeah.
So good. Yeah. And then... I think I had talked to you about 2 Corinthians 4. That whole chapter is on our present weakness and then recognizing resurrection life. But verses 6 through 10 are really good. For God said, the God who said, let light shine out of the darkness, he made his light shine in our hearts to give us his light, the light of his knowledge of God's glory displayed in the face of Jesus. But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. We are hard-pressed on every side, but we're not crushed. We are perplexed, but not in despair, persecuted, but not abandoned. We are struck down, but not destroyed. We always carry around in our body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be revealed in our body. I really like that one.
Right. Because it points to the fact that we are going to face difficulty.
Oh, we are. Yeah.
But whatever that difficulty is, even if it feels like we have been beat down, God's faithfulness is still there.
Yeah. I like that. Struck down, but not destroyed.
Right.
Like, Jesus was struck down, but he was not destroyed. I love that. So, Abraham did have God's promise given to him personally, and he still failed. But we have so many scriptures that we can carry around in our hearts so that we can know and live and breathe. And what a treasure that is.
We
can have that. So, do you have anything more to add?
No, I'm just looking forward to continuing the story because it's just sort of an up and down with Abram. I mean, again, this week, as I said, we'll talk about God talking to him about covenant. And even in that story, Abram struggling a little bit with what's going on and waiting for God's promises to be fulfilled. So it's that interplay, that tension between faith and struggle will still be present. I think there's so much to learn in that. So hopefully we'll do that again Sunday.
Yeah. I think that tension is going to be there until Christ returns, right?
Well, it is. And, you know, it's in some ways with the story of Abram and Sarah, we have that tension for 25 years of their life waiting on a son. And it's there's some resolution when Isaac is born, but it doesn't make everything go away. But then you're right. I mean, we see that tension all the way through the life of the people of Israel and then into the New Testament and Jesus. And then now we're in the midst of that tension again, waiting on his return. So yeah, that doesn't leave the story.
Yeah. It's the now and the not yet.
Absolutely.
And we look back at them and they were living in the now and the not yet. And we're still living in the now and the not yet.
That's right.
But he gives us tools and we can learn from what Abram did right and what Abram did wrong. And we can learn from that. And hopefully the generations behind us can learn from us too.
That's right.
All right. So until next week, let's just keep living in the now and the not yet.
That's right.
All right. We'll talk
to you later. Ask the questions. All right.
Yes, ask the questions. Bye.